We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to perpetualchesspod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to an adult improver, or is it a senior sustainer edition of Perpetual Chess? We will discuss that in a minute. And I am joined actually by a guest co-host, a friend of the pod, and a guest. And I will introduce them both in a minute, but I just wanted to go over one or two things before that. One of them is a friend and listener of the pod who shall remain anonymous, asked me, what do I mean when I say something's in the show notes? So I wanted to quickly address that for anyone else who is not an avid podcast listener and maybe doesn't know when me or any other podcast host says that. Basically, what that means is if you read the description of a given podcast, you'll find lots more details, often links to things that we reference. And different podcast feeds, like if you listen on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or whatever it may be, they have different restrictions about what you can put in the notes. So sometimes on like Apple Podcasts, it'll cut off in the middle. And that's not my doing, that's their doing. So I do my best to have like lots of details right in the show notes. Some other podcasts, like Tim Ferriss, for example, he puts his show notes on his webpage. People do it differently. For me, it's all, I try to put it in the show notes, but if it's not there, it's always on the webpage. If you go to perpetualchesspod.com and then go to that episode, that's where anything where you see me mention like Artur Yusupov and you're like, who's Artur Yusupov? And then you can go and look up, or if there's a chess game referenced, I try to track all that stuff down for you guys as best I can. So that's what we mean when we say there's a link in the show notes. The other thing I wanted to mention was on the last Adult Improver pod, I had solicited volunteers to come talk about their chess experience from fellow amateurs. And actually, our guest this week is one of the people who answered that call. But I wanted to encourage people to keep doing that. But the other thing I wanted to say is, so I used a link in the show notes for that call. And it's really helpful if you use that link instead of emailing me, because then if I'm thinking about addressing a certain theme in an Adult Improver episode, I can just go to one place. It feeds into a Google form, and then I can just go through the list. And obviously, it's a lot of people. I can't reply to all of the emails, but that way I can just go to the list and look. So I'm really happy to get as many people volunteering or suggesting friends of theirs or their coaches or whatever it may be as you all want. But it is best to use the link in the show notes when you do that. So with those two announcements out of the way, let's introduce our guest co-host, who longtime listeners of the podcast will be familiar with. He is a Chess Steps trainer and a Chessable author of 6 courses. He is a New in Chess author. He often writes about national champions for them. He is also a chess dad. His daughter, Lisa, won the silver and bronze at the Girls World Youth Championships. She also won the Women's Dutch Championship at age 19 with a performance rating of 25.58. His daughter Donna was also a champion. She was the first girl to win the youth championships in the Netherlands ahead of Robin Van Kampen and many other current GMs. So just remarkable achievements by his daughters. And he's an excellent trainer, and I've collaborated with him before. And you guys can hear our full interview in episode 142 from 2019, if you have not heard that already. So before we introduce our guest, let's welcome Han Schut back to Perpetual Chess. Welcome, Han.
Thank you, Ben. And thank you for the introduction. It's good to be back. I was in episode 142. In 2019, I still get questions about the Chess Steps method based on that podcast. So it says something about the popularity of your podcast. Congratulations. Also, thank you for selecting one of my courses, the Dubov Explosive Italian, as one of your favorite Chessable courses. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. So recently there was a sale on Chessable and they asked me to pick some of my favorite courses. And Han is one I was familiar with. Dubov's Explosive Italian is a fun line. And as someone who hasn't been playing E4 as much lately, but a lifetime E4 player, I was always looking for something offbeat because the Roy and the Spanish, the Roy and the Italian, they just get repetitive, and the Scotch isn't that good, let's be real. Han found a nice opening that is pretty offbeat. So I recommend, and he did a great job on the course. So I recommend listeners check that out. And we have questions from listeners for both our guest and Han, but without further ado, we need to introduce our guest. So our guest is named Paul Hedrick, and he is a New Mexico-based teacher. And contra a lot of the people who emailed me recently about potentially being adult improver guests, our guest Paul said he has no interest in getting better at chess, or at least his primary goal is sustainment. And funny enough, for listeners who heard my recent podcast discussing the mammoth book of the world's greatest chess games with Christopher Chabri guest co-hosting, and Graham Burgess joined us, there was a question from longtime listener and friend of the pod, Tyron Ross Price, calling himself a senior sustainer. And I had just recently before that received that email from Paul. So I felt like it was fate. And I felt like I'm overdue to sort of, you know, talk about themes different than just like, 20-something dude who's gained 600 points or whatever it might be recently. So I'm excited to get a different perspective and to finally welcome Paul to the show. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks. And sorry, Paul, I'm not used to giving like 6-minute soliloquies at the beginning of the show, but I'm quite happy to have you. So let's get into it, Paul. So, Han and I were chatting about this interview before we joined you, and we were saying that to us it feels like there's a fundamental tension, because I don't think it's that unusual that you've decided your goal is not necessarily to get better at chess. I've mentioned before, I think that's admirable, and I think a lot of people come to that conclusion. But I think what was different to me is that you're still listening to a podcast about chess improvement. So could you square that circle for us?
That's a good question. So I love the stuff of chess. I love the I love chess books. I love chess games. I love the broadcast chess tournaments and the big matches. And your podcast is just it's part of the chess landscape for me, and so I'm happy to hear what other people are doing, and I'm like I love the book recaps that you have on here, and it's not that sort of thing isn't study per se, right? It's it doesn't lead to any kind of rating gain, but it's all part of this world that I really like a lot. So that's where that's coming from.
Well, I appreciate that you appreciate chess culture, because in doing this podcast, I've come to realize that, you know, I think as you spend more time with chess, often you come to appreciate that. But when someone's new to the game, what they love the most is the game, you know, and they want to get better at the game, which I also understand that perspective. And by the way, I wanted to read what Paul wrote when he volunteered, which was, one quote was, "However, my goal is no longer improvement or rating increases. I'm now aiming for nothing more than maintenance. I'll be content if I can win or draw the occasional game, lose without glaringly obvious blunders, and above all, maintain my interest in chess as a rewarding pastime." So, I loved reading that, but what compelled you to volunteer, given that we are often improvement oriented here on these particular episodes?
Well, I've been listening to the podcast for several months, and every time an adult improver comes on, there's always sort of a disconnect between where I am right now as an almost 60-year-old man, right, who's just getting back into this and just trying to kind of dabble and do what I can, and many of the adult improvers who come on, like I think it was you had a gentleman on maybe last week who's like, he has this very ambitious study program with like years long. This year I'm doing tactics. This year I'm doing
Neil Bruce, right,
exactly, yeah. Right. And so when you put out the cattle call, I was. I started initially to write and say, I would love to hear this sort of guest, a guest that that is in my position. And then that sort of morphed into, well, I guess I'm asking for this sort of guest, or maybe I'm volunteering, I'm not really sure. So it was, a desire on my part to hear if there's anybody else in my position and right now as someone who's just coming back to the game and no longer has the ambition that I did, say, when I was 28. So that's where I was coming from.
So Paul,
yes.
So I have a question about the why, right? Yeah. The why you play chess, and let me give you my spectrum, right? So I live in Florida, and there are a lot of seniors who play here in the libraries. They're not concerned about rating. They like the trash talk, they like to talk some politics, and they just like to have a good time together, right? As if they are on a golf course, but then it's chess. On the other hand, when I interview my national champions, of course, they like to travel. They like to be in different cultures. They like to meet different people, make new friends, right? So what is it for you that you say that is why I like to play chess?
So it's absolutely, and this is true going all the way back to when I first picked up chess. It's always been the people for me. This is what I have a real difficult time with online chess, because there's no presence there, right? There's no, yeah. There's no personality. I don't get a sense of my opponent. And chess has always been the most rewarding for me when I am part of a group, like this group of seniors that you're describing right now. They remind me a lot of the guys that I've just started playing with over the last few months. Many of them, as far as I know, they don't even know the names of openings. They would have no idea who Magnus Carlsen is, for example. Yeah. They have no interest in writing their games down or going back over them later. They just sit down, they play some chess. When it's over, flip around the board, off they go again, right? And but it's just the fact that I'm getting to know these guys. They're fun. We have this one thing in common. They really, really want to beat me. That personal presence, right? Having that, you know, a face on the other side of a real board, kind of, yes. It kind of brings the intensity of the game experience to a certain level that I enjoy. If I didn't have any people around, I would not be able to play this game. Honestly, I just I'm not an online chess kind of person.
But it seems like your interest is a little bit deeper than the people you describe. Again, getting back to sort of your following high level chess, and you know, I know you've got an affinity for chess literature. And by the way, I should have mentioned that Paul's peak rating was in the low 1300s, and you stopped. Your last tournament was in 2009. And you also mentioned in one of your messages, you don't really have any interest in tournaments going forward. Can you confirm or deny that?
Yeah, no, that is true. I've decided I just have no business in tournaments at all. I'm as low as my rating is. I my level of play, I'm sure, is miles below that, and so it would be I don't know. My ego would not be able to withstand watching that sort of, you know, spiraling descent down into the three digits. So I am confirming that. Yes.
But what makes you think that? That your play has deteriorated?
I'm playing a couple times a week as part of my job. I sponsor a chess club over at my school, and I can tell just by the frequency of my horrible mistakes when I'm playing these kids some of these kids are, I think the highest rated kid is 1200, and I think the lowest rated is 700, and I think any of those kids can beat me on a given day. So just based on that, I would say my rating is much, much lower than the low 1300s from a decade ago.
And Han, feel free to hop in whenever you have a question. But when you did play tournaments, we chatted about it a little bit when we talked last week. Did you generally enjoy it, Paul?
I did. I mean, it's a mixed bag, right? It certainly is a rewarding experience. Say playing in a 5-round weekend tournament with a nice long, nice slow time control, but it's also exhausting. And I think we may have chatted about this once. There's eventually maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 times in the course of a weekend, I would find myself scratching my head, thinking, "Why on earth am I doing this to myself? I could be doing something much, much more relaxing." But it's very addictive. I mean, right? Even now, even having decided, okay, this is my tournament days are over, I find myself sort of trying to live vicariously through the people I know who are still playing in tournaments. One of the seniors that I play with, he's a 1900 rated player, and I'll always ask him. I think, as far as I know, he's the only rated player in this group. You'll ask him when he's going to play in the next one. I have a good friend that we play with once a month, and I'll bother him. All right, what tournament are you getting ready for? And even the students, I do it. It's embarrassing. Hey, have you seen this tournament? You should really play in this, and then tell me all about it, so I don't have to do it. So I still feel the call for sure.
Han, you've mentioned stuff like that too, right, Han? How often, like, and I feel this way too, like a fellow amateur player who you know is playing actively, you can often be as eager to see how they did as you might, like, you know, what's going on in Viking Z or whatever it might be.
Of course, yes. So You said the company is very important, right? The meeting face to face and just having a good time together. But if, and then if you look to the chess activity yourself, is it for you like a intellectual challenge, or how do you approach the game itself?
So that's I always like having a project going at any given time, and I think this is just maybe stems from my job. Teaching, especially at the beginning of the year, is just it's a big project that requires a lot of preparation and a lot of walk around thinking about it all the time. And it's something to that I'll work on daily. So I like to have another project that is just for fun. That's just for me. Maybe fun is the wrong word. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Playing through end games at 5 o'clock in the morning over my cup of coffee is actually fun, but it's something that keep me occupied, keep me mentally engaged, the same way mm-hmm. that my work does. If I'm not doing something like that, like playing through these positions every morning, I just get bored. I don't know what to do with myself. So it's something to keep me to keep my mind occupied, right? Give me something to work
mentally engaged.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so you write also what you're doing, right? So the first thing was like playing people in real life over the board. The second thing was basic tactics and end games. Then you are reviewing master games, and that fits also in this picture that you're portraying of this chess landscape being a literature and history teacher. So I can appreciate that it fits into that. Some openings and some planning you mentioned rarely.
A little.
So can you expand on basically your chess activities?
Sure. The master games thing. I have the book right here. It's a little. I described it as idiosyncratic. I'm very interested in master games played during a certain period from 1966 to 1972. And so I have kind of a best of list from that period. I'm right now working my way through them. I have them written down on a little card, and I try to memorize the game first, just to, actually, I'm not really sure why I memorize it, but it's a challenge. It's hard to do. In a way, memorizing a game almost is like building muscle memory, is the only analogy I can think of it. I'm playing right now through a Larsen Petrosian game from this tournament from Sanomaca, 1966.
The second Pierre Gorski Cup.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is a wonderful book. I love this book.
Who's the author for listeners who
it's edited by Isaac Kazhdan, and it's a Dover book. And the one thing that I would warn your listeners against is at least the version I
know
have,
where this is going.
Yeah, is in the dreadful descriptive notation.
Yes. And
wow, I that would be wonderful if Dover had re-released this in algebraic, because I think this is what put me off chess when I was like six. Descriptive notation just makes no sense to me. But I try to understand the moves of both sides, right? Win or lose. And then I go from there, and I'll look at the openings. I'll see what the state of those openings are. Like, for example, it's a Sicilian dragon, that Larsen and Petrosian are playing in this game that I'm going over. And just see what the opening looks like in the 21st century. And then just laboriously work my way through the notes until I've just had enough of it. I have no particular goal in mind. Again, this is just something that to keep me immersed in chess stuff. In this case, history. In this case, a good book. for the readers again, I'd say I really recommend this book because in most of the games in this tournament book, the editor asked both players to annotate the game. And so you'll get very different viewpoints on the same position from both players, and they wrote them independently. So just as from a literary point of standpoint, it's unique in chess literature, I think. But anyway, but I digress.
Yeah, and it's a legendary tournament. I mean, Petrosian was the sitting world champion, and you have the next two world champions playing in it. In Spassky and Fischer, because I had to look it up when you mentioned the email that you were interested from Santa Monica, 1966 to, was it Texas?
San Antonio, 1972. Yeah.
So, I was like, those are very specific.
Yeah. And San Antonio, 1972, that's an RHM book, again, in descriptive notation. And that one is just, that's an odd tournament. Petrosian is in it again. Fischer is now world champion. And Karpov plays in it, a young Karpov. And of course, he's a new up and comer and he destroys everybody. Do you guys remember Chess Digest, the distributor out of Dallas? Either of you familiar with that? So Ken Smith was the guy who owned Chess Digest.
Of the Smith-Morra Gambit.
Yeah, exactly. And he actually plays in this tournament. Doesn't do particularly well, but it's a unique tournament. And to me, it covers the period of chess that I'm most interested in, that sort of age of Fischer, because that's what got me, that's what I recall. Well, as you both know now, but from reading my story, that's what really got me hooked on chess. When I was a little kid, the fact that there's this guy on the news who is playing chess somewhere far away, and I knew what chess was as a little kid. So it's that time period that I'm most fascinated with.
And let me ask you, Paul, so you described sort of atrophying in your chess game. I hope you don't consider that like too harsh a term.
It's a kind term, I think, yes.
Okay. And you obviously exude enthusiasm for chess still. And when you did play your last tournament, you know, your rating was at its peak at that time. So at least most of the people who typically listen to the Adult Improver episodes, they might say, well, you know, I'm a little rusty. You know, I'm making more blunders than I would like. So I'm going to get to work on that. I'm going to, you know, do an hour of tactics a day and see if that helps. So does that just sound unappealing to you, or you just don't care enough? Or, I mean, and again, well, no judgment. I'm not hearing your enthusiasm, but I'm just curious.
When I first really started studying chess, I was in my late 20s. And again, it was Bobby Fischer's fault. Fischer Spassky 2 started, and I was like, oh my God, Fischer is back. I have to learn chess so I can follow these games. I started a years-long study program. I mean, I got anything I could grab, get my hands on, I would try to read. Every study program that I could find, I would pay attention to it. And okay, I have to read this book now, and I have to do this and learn these. And so, and I did that for years, and I just found, you know, much to my shock, that really I'm just not that good at chess. As much as I love it, I'm just not a very strong player. I don't have the, you know, whatever that, you know, that quality. I don't have any kind of the necessary chess talent that would get me to, you know, 1800 and above, as the study plans always say. I'm like, oh, here I come. Nope, it wasn't to happen. So I just feel like I've done it all, right? I feel like I've like in those years I tried everything, and I got a little better, but after a while, it sort of hit this point of diminishing returns, right? Where the amount of work that you're putting into a study program is not producing returns and as far as rating points go. So what I'm trying to do right now is just kind of find a middle ground between, I'll do a little bit of work so I don't get, I don't forget how the pieces move. But I also don't want to put in so much work that it, that it makes me miserable when I'm not seeing myself, suddenly become an expert, right?
Yeah.
When you play your games, your casual games, do you still notate them?
Do you still record them?
Yeah. Do you evaluate your games or not?
He's holding up a scorebook.
I bought a scorebook just for the occasion. My last scorebook that I found I had filled up, I bought in 1993. So I thought, okay, it's time to buy a new one. I go through. I'll put them into one of the online engines and just sort of play through it. I don't really have anybody to analyze with, like these. I only see these guys once a week, and like I said, they just want to play. So I'll put them through the engines and pay attention to what the engine suggests. I'll try to find a balance between, the engine is suggesting that and I would never make that move in a million years, but what would I do? What does seem like a logical move to me? And sort of approach computer analysis that way. Of course, some days I'm just, really what I'm just trying to do is make sure that this stuff, that the chess notation is actually correct. That's sometimes the battle. It's like, wait, that the knight cannot move that way. And, just to actually, remember where all the squares are. So, my goals are sometimes quite low.
Okay. Well, Paul, we've got to take a break soon, but I want to dive into one listener question. We've got some good ones for you. And this one is related to what you were just touching on. So I figured now is a good time to ask. So this one is from Thomas Optikul. Thomas, I hope I said that right. Thanks for supporting the podcast via Patreon, Thomas. And Thomas wrote in and asked, he said, as a 40-year-old father of three rated around 1,200 ELO, I feel I'll have to be realistic about what I can achieve in chess as well. I'm curious if Paul can recall the moment when he altered his mindset from how to improve to how to still enjoy chess while recognizing that serious improvement is not probable. Was this shift of mindset a conscious effort or rather a slow development?
Yeah, that was a great question. My answer to that is both. There was a moment 10 years ago or so when I briefly got back into tournament play and I realized I think this is as good as I'm going to get. And then I stopped playing. The slow part was coming back to it now. In my late 50s and thinking, okay, well, this is obviously still a part of my experience. This is still something that I value. What do I do? There's got to be a way that I can make this work, that I can still make this a part of my life without, being so, without fretting over rating points and tournament results. So it was an initial realization followed by kind of a long, slow realization.
But again, you did stop at your peak. So what made you think this was as good as you would get?
I played in a quad against three other players about my same rating. This is when I was living up in Santa Fe, and I had really been seeing since I'd come back. It had been another 10 years before then that I hadn't played. I was playing just the games of my life, and I played in that quad, and I just there was something about it, my performance in that quad, that just made me that led me to that conclusion. It's like, this is as good as I get.
Okay, well, I mean, I just want to be clear for listeners. I'm really enjoying hearing Paul's perspective. But I want to be clear that I do think Paul can get better at chess, but I fully support his decision. You don't have to want to get better at chess. There's no, you know, that's totally valid. Chess is a beautiful game that I think lots of people, could take a possibly healthier approach of just appreciating the game and not obsessing over rating points. So all in all, I think it's admirable, even though I do think that you didn't necessarily achieve your best, Paul.
Well, all right. Good. See, you shouldn't tell me this, Ben, because now that's going to stick in my brain. And let's see. What tournament is coming up next?
Yeah, I'll get an angry email after you lost to a 5-year-old.
That's right. Damn you, Ben Johnson.
All right. Well, we are overdue for a break, but we've got some great listener questions to continue to dive into. So we will be back in a minute. Listeners, I just got an update from aimchess.com, and unfortunately, I'm still behind on the clock 72% of the time. Working to get better, progress is not just a straight line upward, but I am getting better in the other aspects of your game, which aimchess can measure, which are openings, tactics, endings, advantage capitalization, and resourcefulness. And of course, aimchess automatically gathers your games from the major chess playing sites to give you actionable insights and even quiz you on tactics that you may have missed during your game. So please go to aimchess.com and check out the product. And if you do decide to subscribe, use the promo code perpetual30 to get a discount on aimchess.com. And we are back, and we're going to dive right into another question from a Patreon supporter of the podcast. This one is from Martin Wach. Thanks for the support, Martin. And Martin, his first question, I think Paul has answered, which is for Paul, where do you find enjoyment in chess if your rating is staying about the same? I think he's covered that in full. And then he also asked for Paul and Han, at what point would somebody decide to transition from sustainment mode, meaning, you know, you're admitting or approaching things such that you just want to keep your level and you're not really trying to get better, to improver mode or back? So Han, since you've got a lot of experience working with adults, maybe you could tackle that one. And Paul, welcome to chime in as well.
So I think it's like a personal decision, and you have to decide what you want to get out of chess. So if you are, like I mentioned, like a senior who likes to play in a library with other seniors, who likes to trash talk and likes the chess landscape, as Paul described, that's perfectly fine. At the same time, I'm coaching an adult improver who just started, and he was 49, and he is a medical doctor, and he is disciplined and determined, and I'm sure that he reached now 1600 in a few months.
Wow!
I'm sure that he will go above 1800. I just want to say also, I think it's really your choice, right? I think also if you look at the time period that we are in with COVID, with the war in the Ukraine, with climate change, there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of people with mental health issues. I think you should also be able to say, I make a choice that chess for me should just be fun. It's not for improvement. I just like to engage in this activity. I like to be part of a community. This is kind of self-care, and this is not about my rating improvement. So I think especially in this time, there should not be judgment about whether you what you get out of chess or what you're. It's a personal choice. But I believe that whether you're 50 or 55, there's still room to improve. It's different when you're a grandmaster and someone you would come to me and say, I'm 2,500, I'm over 50, I want to get to 2,700. That's a different issue. But when you are a club player and you're 50, you're determined and you're disciplined, you can improve. I'm sure about that. But it is a choice. And it's not a bad choice if you choose for it to be a fun activity.
Beautifully said, Han. Yeah, I agree. Anything to add, Paul?
I nailed it. I think maybe the only thing I'd add is from the sustainer perspective is I could see getting back into tournament play if I could find a way to disconnect my ego from the whole rating thing, right? And that would, I'd love to hear how people are doing that. Like I see people who, you know, some of the folks in the Albuquerque area, you know, who have peaked, you know, years ago and now are really just, their ratings are going down, older people. But if they can, if they're finding something in the tournament experience, right, or preparing for tournaments and doing, you know, the following study plans and stuff, that would kind of like, just balance out the whole the rating concern with rating points. I think it would that would be enough to shift over, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, I struggle with it even just in online play, but obviously to a much greater extent when you play tournament chess. I mean, it's really the only, it's like your report card, you know, or at least it's natural to think of it that way. So it's hard to disentangle oneself from sort of identifying as your rating, but I certainly advocate not doing so, but just conceding that it's a challenge. So we had another listener comment from another person who really identified with the story you told, Paul. And I had shared some of what you'd written with Patreon subs. And again, this is one I think you've already touched on, but it was from Jack Russell who mentioned, he said, do you prioritize studying things that you think are fun and would be fun to learn, regardless of if they help you improve or not? I think that we can call that a yes, right?
It's yes and no. Like I said earlier, I can't say that going through all these positions from the comprehensive chess course are particularly fun, right? And it feels repetitive, but that's what I'm trying to do. But going through Bent Larson's games is very fun, right? That's very much fun. So some of it, I think, is just work, necessary work. It's like it's like trying to remember how to speak a language, right? And the more you hear it, the more fluent you get. So going through those positions every morning that I've been doing, that's just, you know, that's like just practicing my chess language.
Yeah, like your scales. Yeah.
Yeah.
But why do that at all? If you're just in it for the enjoyment at this stage, like why not just be like 100%? I'm going to review the master games that I enjoy.
Because I really don't enjoy playing chess when I do very badly. That's the thing. Okay. I don't mind losing. Right. Like I don't mind losing fair and square. But if I lose because of something just absolutely like hanging a piece, right? That just drives me crazy. And I still do that. I do that all the time. If I can just stop doing that, I don't care if I get crushed every game. It's fine, right? As long as I'm not beating myself. So the reason I'm doing that stuff is to try to avoid beating myself in every game. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and we had a Patreon question that's exactly on that note, because he mentioned that what you wrote about how your updated goal is, quote, to lose without glaringly obvious blunders. Alex Friedman wrote and said that really resonated with him. And he asked how you feel all the studying is affecting this goal. Like, do you feel like what you're doing is helping?
That was a good question. But one that's very hard to answer, because I don't know if I would be dropping pieces every game if I wasn't doing this, right? I'd like to think so. I still am dropping pieces. If I not every game, I've had some fantastic games over the last 3 months. I mean, some games that I'm actually proud of. But still, I can count on once a week playing a game where I just, drop a bishop just for no reason. If I played every game without dropping a minor piece, my inner Ben Johnson would start telling me, okay, go to a tournament. Go play in a tournament.
That's all my fault.
Yes, it would even have your voice, Ben. It would.
Now, Han, let me ask you. I'm sure you get asked by some of your students. I mean, we all want to mitigate our blunders. So what advice would you give, like following up on Alex's question, from what is your typical advice, Han, to limit blunders and at the dropping pieces level especially?
Yes. So when you look to the chess steps method, what you try to do is separate the orientation on the position, and then afterwards, the calculation and the visualization. And what I notice is that if people take more time for the orientation, and of course we know the obvious things to look at, unprotected pieces, checks, threats, right? Those are the obvious ones, and you look at them while you select your move, and you visualize when you're about to make your move, what will be the new position. But what I notice is if you can separate this orientation from the calculation and not mix them together, that you see a lot more and that your blunders will be less.
So yeah. The orientation being like looking at the map and the calculation being like the directions?
So orientation, right? So in the step method, you have, of course, the technical side, and I mentioned the obvious ones, which is unprotected pieces, the checks on the king, the threats I was mentioning. But of course, there are other elements like two pieces which are on one line. You can have, and that's one thing that's really struck me over the last 2 years, pieces which have a central defending task. That they are as bad a defender as a pinned piece. So you look at your position and say, which pieces have a central defending task? So there is, you have your checklist of all the elements that you have to look at, pieces which don't have a lot of squares to go to that might potentially get trapped and are not on pre at the moment. So there is this list that I also shared in my presentation. And that's what you look at. And when you are complete in that, I noticed that, first of all, you see a lot more combinations that are in the position, but also you will start stopping to overlook dropping pieces or falling for easy tactics.
Okay. And Han, a lot of listeners, I think, will have heard the steps method come up on the podcast, especially if they've heard our prior interview. But could you give a brief description of what it is for anyone who has not heard it discussed previously?
So it's a Dutch curriculum, and it brings you from novice to master level. It is 6 manuals with scripted lessons, 27 workbooks. And the workbooks are typically about 50 pages and 12 exercises on each page. And so in total, it's about 14,000 exercises. And it was the method for the Dutch Chess Federation, and it has gained popularity in the States, but also in Germany and in other European countries, but also in countries like Turkey. And so it has become very popular across the world. And yeah, like I said, it brings you from novice to master level, and it includes all elements of the game.
Yeah, and it's a great curriculum. We'll have more on it later. We're actually going to take another break, and then we've got a few more questions from listeners to dig into. New courses from our friends at Chessable.com include Adiban's E4 a lifetime repertoire from the entertaining Indian Grandmaster. Speaking of entertaining, I Am Andras Toth has an E4 for Beginners course out that I think is a great choice if you're newer to chess and looking to tighten up your opening repertoire with white. Grandmaster Simon Williams, the Ginger GM, is out with a video version of the classic book, The Life and Games of Mikhail Tal. That's coming in April. So there's lots of good stuff. And of course, whatever you get from Chessable, it includes their proprietary move trainer technology, which utilizes spaced repetition to make sure you remember the patterns that you learn. So be sure to go to chessable.com and check out their full library of courses that are available both for free and for purchase. And we are back, and we're going to get to our next listener question, which is from Ed Daly, and it is for all three of us, he says. So his question is, do you think you need to have some level of improvement in order to just sustain your current level? He's 60 years old, didn't start playing until his late 30s, hit his peak rating about 10 years ago, and now is almost 250 points below his peak. It may be wishful thinking, but I think I'm a better player today than I was 10 years ago. But I also think the level of competition, the tools available, the boom in chess interest, etc., requires continued improvement just to keep pace. Interested in your views. Now, Han, you and I have talked about this offline, so maybe I'll let you take this first.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some rating deflation going on. And I mean, you just have to picture like a 10-year-old child, girl or boy who comes to the chess tournament and who has mastered 12 chess openings on Chessable, who has done all the tactics and has a 2700 tactics rating on chess.com or Lead Chess, and who has a, let's say, a blitz rating or a rapid rating online from 2400, and who comes in there and he says, I'm a 1600, right? And then, so I think that's kind of the picture, that there are indeed a lot of tools, and I think for youth players, this whole gaming effect that you study on Chessable, you memorize your openings, you know exactly the lines, so they're well prepared, they're tactically sharp, and I even see it reflected in the step method that you have positional aspects like vulnerability and activity. They're still much more difficult. But when you go to typical tactical elements like double attack and things like that, people are so much stronger at the moment. And you can take them to steps higher because they are mastering that through different means.
Yeah. And I've talked about this before, so I won't say too much, but I'll just say I agree with Han. You know, when I interviewed James Altucher, he's someone who was also USCF master who spent 20 years away from chess and came back and mentioned he definitely felt like players were stronger. And I know he's come back and lost a bit of rating since then, even though he's working really hard on his chess. So I think it's pretty unequivocal, Ed, that, and I don't know what happens at the top, but basically just, you know, human knowledge about chess is expanding quite quickly. So the rating system is not necessarily designed for that level of change. And as I talked about my interview with Mark Glickman, a rating system that adapted to more recent results might help with that. But anyway, Ed, we definitely feel your pain. And Paul, since you're not playing rated tournaments, you may not experience it as much. But what do you see in terms of working with the kids at the chess club? Are they making use of these new tools?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. These kids, this seemed shocking to me, but apparently this is normal. Some of these kids had never played on what I consider a real board before August. They've spent the last, the better part of a year in lockdown. And so first, then the school had no chess boards at all. So first thing I did was got some real chess boards in there, and it was a new experience for them. They play on chess.com all the time. And they love talking about the kids who are really serious love talking about their chess.com ratings, and they're really into it. So especially, say, as the pandemic was winding down out here, a lot of kids were on chess.com. I think it's tapered off some, but they're still there. They're still using this stuff.
And Paul, it's funny that you mentioned chess.com because it is time for our sponsored segment, the chess.bomb. For listeners who have not heard this, on 2022 Adult Improver episodes, we are highlighting a particular feature that we like of chess.com. And in this case, I had asked Paul if there were any features that he particularly enjoyed. And he mentioned the chess.com Explorer, which is basically a big online database, which features an opening explorer. I think a lot of listeners will be familiar with your ability to sort of play through a handful of moves and then like see which moves are the most popular. It's a great way to just figure out what openings pique your interest. And then that sort of feeds into the master's database, which, Paul, I understand that that's the feature that you enjoy from chess.com most.
Yeah, that's right. And it's because of my interest in these older games. I like looking at, particularly in the openings, I can look at how the openings were played in 1966 and then sort of trace the DNA of the opening back in time and forward in time very easily using that interface. And I can also go through the games with the engine going and learn a lot that way. I also like taking these master games and going to the point where one of the masters resigned and trying to play through against the computer from the winning side to see if I can actually win it. And that database makes that very possible too. So it all kinds of different aspects of the game you can use the master's database for.
Yeah, and what you mentioned, playing out resigned positions, is a good training tool. And also in the Masters database, those of you who heard my interview with Grandmaster Johan Helsten, he was talking about how, you know, you can pick a certain role model and a certain opening, and the Masters database is great for that. Like if you want to look at like Nakamura, Kasparov's King's Indian games, you can just search for that. And they also have an archive where you can use the Explorer to sort of cycle through your own games. And all of this stuff, of course, you can copy and paste the games and put them in your own personal library, which even if you're a free chess.com member, you can store, I think it's up to like 1,000 games. And then it's even more than that if you are a Diamond member, which, by the way, if you do choose to upgrade your membership to take advantage of all of chess.com's premium features, be sure to use the link in the description. There we go again, in order to help support Perpetual Chess. So I believe that concludes our chess.bomb. And we've got a couple more questions to get to. As we mentioned, we did have some questions from Han for relating to the steps method. So, Paul, feel free to hop in because I know we were talking before we recorded, and that you didn't have much familiarity with the steps method. So, you know, if a question occurs to you, there's a good chance people listening who aren't familiar with it may have the same question. Okay. So, welcome your perspective while you're here. And this question is from Mark Miller. I know that Mark has taken a liking, as Han mentioned, a lot of people here in the U.S. have, to the step method. And Paul, I mean, since you run a chess program, run an after-school club, you may want to look into it as well. It's a good way to sort of, tons of lessons in it and lots of puzzles to give kids and so on. Anyway, Mark's question is, for those teachers and players who are fans of the steps method, there doesn't seem to be an easy way to gain certification in the method, nor much of a push to increase opportunities for doing so in the U.S. This is to gain teacher certification. Has Han ever taught instructors in this method? If not, would he be willing to? And what is his thinking about greater adoption in the U.S. or even federation approval?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Mark. So we had a previous guest on the Perpetual Chess podcast, Job de Lamar, and he was someone who was giving out certifications. I work with Cor van Weijerde, and he is not really interested to set up an international program. And personally, I prefer to work on a one-on-one basis with my students and not to get into the organizing business of certifications. I do think your suggestion that the Federation should look into this, I support that. I think if you look to the U.S. Chess Federation, they should provide more infrastructure for scholastic chess and also for trainers in general. And I think when you look in overall to the U.S. Chess Federation, there are a lot of functions that they do that you also see covered by chess.com and other at Chess24 in terms of news and things like that. And I think it would be good if they focus more on providing an infrastructure for US chess.
Yeah.
That being said, I gave in 2019 a presentation on the Chess Steps method for the US Chess Federation on the Nationals. I'm 2 years further down the road, learned a lot by teaching. And I'm going to give this presentation on YouTube. So that will be on Saturday, April 16th. It will be in the show notes. and I invite everyone to be there. It will not be a typical 10 to 15 minutes. It will be like 2 hours. So if you have any questions about the steps methods and the contents, I hope you are there. It will be a live presentation on YouTube, and I will take any questions, and I expect it to be 1 to 2 hours.
Okay. Sounds like a great opportunity. And yeah, just to echo what Han said, I know, I think Mark, there's definitely a frustration. I've certainly gotten some emails, you know, over the years, having talked about the steps method on the program. And as you said, having interviewed Yop about it, there is a frustration that Core, who of course is the co-creator of the steps method and the only living of the co-creators, he's just not that interested in expanding it. And I don't know, I don't know if that's going to change. But as Han said, on the US side, you know, John Hartman, obviously friend of the pod, Chess Life magazine editor, is a huge fan of the Chess Steps method. So I have no inside information, but certainly I like Han, would hope that maybe the US Chess Federation from their side could do a little more to like formally implement things. But there's not going to be like official Dutch certification forthcoming, unfortunately. Yes, go ahead, Paul.
I have a question for Han about the Chess Steps method. I feel as like I should represent the older sustainer / improver crowd. How would you recommend approaching the program as say an older player, where you've sort of reached a certain level in your chess strength and you're looking to improve, looking to get better, or looking to stay the same? What would you recommend to an adult as far as approaching this program? Who's been around the block?
It depends on your ambition. So if I look to myself, I've never had a coach in my whole life. And you can, of course, use the manuals and do the exercises and train by yourself. But one of the things of the step method is that you learn to see. So when I am having students, I'm constantly asking them questions. So I'm not giving, it's not like instruction that I'm telling them. No, I ask them questions. And over time, they start to see. And that's the only thing that's, of course, difficult if you read manuals and you have to kind of change yourself. That's a bigger barrier, but it depends on your ambition. Like I said, I never had a coach. I did it myself, and it's possible. But if you have a trainer who is knows the step method really well, and he is using the Socratic method, then it can accelerate your learning, I believe. Okay. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Excellent. And we have one more steps method related question. This one is from Wayne Inkpen. Thanks for supporting Perpetual Chess, Wayne. And Wayne asks, he says, what chess books make excellent complements to the steps series? As I understand it, it does not include information about openings. I suspect general opening books as opposed to specific opening books, he's implying, might be helpful. I also wonder about any complementary material other than these that might be the most useful. Maybe Han can tell us what complements the step course, what to complement the step course with, and at what levels he brings them into the course. At what level do you introduce supplements to the course?
Yes. So I'd like to answer this in a bit broader way than specifically related to books. I would like to answer this, what kind of tools do I use outside the step method for my students and in a broader sense? So the first thing is about, let's start with the opening side. In a step method, of course, you have the golden rules of the opening, develop your pieces, king safety, pawn, control the center, and then related to that, the metaphor that your pieces are an army and that you have to deploy them so efficiently as possible and have good cooperation, and that if you do that, you're the first to attack. So that's the kind of the basis. Then the second part is that in the step method, it basically says you learn your openings by playing games, because playing games and evaluating your games is an essential part of the step method. That being said, what I do is I have a specific method to go about chess openings. I create my own mini books. So I use the Lead Chess database. It's like, I think probably they have about 4 billion games at the moment. And I use the classical games of club players and the rapid games of them. So the serious games, you could say, reasonably serious games. And I select a number of lines of the opening that my student wants to learn. So normally it's like 15, 20 lines. That's it. So you get a playable position, like say an exciting, fun position with imbalances. And I upload that to Chessable and they learn it there within a spaced repetition. So that's what on the opening side. So the Lead Chess database, select on the strengths of the club player and take it from there, and then upload it to Chessable and do your spaced repetition. What I noticed a lot of players have difficulty with is I get my out of the opening, but what do I do next? What are my goals? For that, I used the book on Chessable from Chess Structures from Marcia Flores. So he describes basically when you have a pawn structure, and the pawn structure is related to the opening, what kind of plans go with it. So that's a book in addition to the step method that I use, Chess Structures from Mauricio Flores, looking at plans after the opening. Second to that is looking at games between strong masters and amateurs and deriving from that the typical plans that go with the opening. A lot of players have difficulty after the opening to find a plan. So look at how a strong player beats a weak player, relatively weak player, and what plan they use. So that is the opening part. Then when it comes to playing, of course, like I just mentioned, playing games is a crucial element. Many of my students are playing the Lead Chess 45 League. Shout out to Lead Chess, Lila, Chess Zero, Stockfish, and also the Lead Chess 45 League. Great communities who create great services all for free. And in the Lead Chess 45 League, this is a, let's say, an environment where the student can prepare for the game because they know their opponent and they can look up what kind of openings they play. So you learn in context. And then after that, a lot of players have difficulty with calculation. So they're playing ping pong chess, like Herman Grotemensch calls it, or hope chess, like Heisman calls it. You know the term.
Oh, yeah.
But so what I ask my students to do is when they are playing a game in the Lead Chess 45 League, is to share their calculations. So I don't want general considerations, no orientation.
Hand-waving, as Heisman calls it.
I just want from them candidate moves and variations. And so that's a way for them to practice calculation and to show and to learn to go away from hope chess, but get into the discipline of really calculation during the game. And it's of course great to see afterwards, because you can in the spectator room, you can whisper your calculations, right? So you do it during the game. And afterwards, you can compare notes and say, what were you thinking? So you see the thinking process of your student, and you can see actually what someone missed. So I think that's a nice addition to the step method, also in the COVID time, to play games, but also to learn from them. And it's a unique feature of the Lead Chess 45 League.
All right. Well, that was a much better version of the answer I was going to give, Han, but which was just chess is not just a collection of puzzles. You know, it's every game tells its own story, and you don't want to lose sight of that when you're doing puzzles. You want to both focus on that in your own games, and as you say, as you both have said, learn to appreciate it from reviewing the games of others. In some cases, masters, but it doesn't even have to be like learning from the legends necessarily.
Han, how far into these opening lines do you have your students go out of curiosity? These lines you pull from Lee Chess. How deep into the opening do they go?
That depends, of course, a bit on how forced they are.
Okay.
Right? So, I mean, it becomes a bit technical now, but I'd make like a... I kind of make a tree, and I note in the tree how many games have been played with a certain move. And I go to a certain depth until I have a certain coverage. So I'd like to be, let's say, at 80% and get all everything covered. But so if I look to myself, right, I also created them for myself. Like the Dubov Explosive Italian is the result of a Lee Chess 45-45 game. For me, it's a great way to learn, and it's also a form of active learning. But I created, let's say, a Grünfeld course, which is about 50 lines, and a Dragon course, which is about 50 lines. And I think that's sufficient. So my objective is not to give my students a crushing advantage after the opening because they memorized everything better. No, I want them to have interesting positions and solid foundation in their openings and understand the plans when they get out of the opening.
Cool.
You got some ideas for your chess clubs now, Paul?
Well, maybe for me.
You will hear now multiple voices in your head.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. I got an inner Han in here too.
Excellent. Well, Paul, I think we've covered most of the topics, but I did want to sort of, you know, as you mentioned, and as many of us have had, we all have seasons in our lives when it comes to chess. We have periods of intense interest, and then often, you know, we might set it aside as life circumstances intervene. So do you think, Paul, that you'll stick around the chess world this time?
It really depends on the people. If I can maintain a community of people who are interested in chess outside of work, if these guys I've been playing with continue to maintain their club, if my good friend in Albuquerque maintains his chess interest, I can certainly see it happening. It's really the people for me are the motivating thing, the thing that keep me coming back for more. So it's very possible. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. And that's, you know, that's nice to hear. It's sort of life affirming in a way. Now, you've got this sort of secret interest in chess history, too. So when you get together with your fellow chess enthusiasts who maybe they're not opposed to learning chess history, but they maybe don't pursue it to the degree that you do. Do you tell them, do you start telling them stories about the Piekorski cup and stuff?
No, I've spent too much time around high school students, over the last, 25 years to tell a lot of stories. So I'll just, I'll save it for the right company.
Excellent. Well, I've got one more question for Paul, but before I ask that, Han, do you have any more questions for Paul or anything else to say?
No, I just want to react on one thing that you mentioned, like that you feel that your chess is related to your ego, right?
Right. The rating is, yeah.
Rating is, yeah. Yes. And I think one of the things we have to do is also learn how to separate that, right? You cannot take rating with you in your grave, and we better make it's such a nice game to play. And so I have also students, and it's like what I tell them is throw your ego out of the window, right? Just leave, because it's even a distraction. So just leave it, throw your ego out of the window, and just enjoy the game. And it's very hard, right? It's very hard. But that's, I think it's that helps for a lot of people to improve with their resilience. If you can throw your ego out of the window and say, I'm not defined by my rating. I like this too much. I like this game too much. And I like the company too much.
I think that's fine advice. Very fine advice.
Yeah. And for me in this case, you know, I blame my children, obviously, for anything that goes wrong in my life. But one thing that helps when I play chess is if I'm in a tense moment or I'm worried I'm going to screw something up in a tournament game, or I do screw something up, you know, I can just think of my 6-year-old daughter who couldn't care less, wouldn't know the first thing about, like, even whether I won or lost a game, let alone about my rating. And there's just so many things in life that you can focus on that are way more important, and that, you know, just make any number next to your name just pale in comparison. But it is an ongoing struggle. You do need to remind yourself. It doesn't happen naturally.
That's a very good point. And I'm not really sure how many of us would really enjoy chess as much if we were playing, like, say, Carlsen and Nepo were in that last match. It just it almost seems joyless in a way, right?
Well, Carlsen seems to think he doesn't want to do it again.
Yeah, he'd rather play basketball, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, excellent. Well, I want to thank you both. This has been excellent. Han, thank you for your contributions. I knew that you would add a lot to this conversation, and you did not disappoint. So Han, listeners who listen in time should definitely check out your lecture. Again, link in the show notes. What else should we link in the show notes, Han?
Yeah, of course. Like I've mentioned before, I'm a Chessable author. So, and my courses are designed for club players. And there's a lot of positive response because they are not long-term or lifetime repertoires. No, they're small and fun to play.
Inexpensive, I might add, as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Paul, do you have any, I mean, this has been great. It's been great to hear your perspective. It was overdue to hear someone with a sort of more measured perspective, an amateur with a measured perspective to improvement. Do you have any parting advice to our adult improver listeners, Paul?
I would say, to other fellow adult improvers, I guess.
Or senior sustainers.
Yeah, I would say just get out there and play. I think that the pandemic had a real detrimental effect on face-to-face play, and we can't let it go away. It's too important a thing for all the wonders of chess.com and Lee Chess and all these chess platforms. They're great, but get out there, sit down at a board with a real human being and see. You know learn their name, see their face, and play a game. That's my advice.
That is excellent advice. And just before we say goodbye, listeners, I wanted to give a shout out to recent Perpetual Chess Patreon subs. And I also wanted to mention that Perpetual Chess has finally launched a Discord. We're starting small right now. It's only for the Rook tier, which is those who donate $10 a month to Perpetual Chess. But we may expand as time goes on. But anyway, I wanted to thank recent Perpetual Chess subs, Jim Papadakis, John Fallon, Mathieu DeRue, I apologize, Matthew, Morgan Francis, Justin Bapti, Joel Fulton, Joel Weiner, and Steve Wu, which is not his real name, but I was excited to say Steve Wu, so whatever. So thanks again to Paul and Han, and thanks to everyone who is for listening, and we will catch you all next week.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give Major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network.